This is an interview with Alan Chapman from the University of Oxford. For the full show and the archives, go to www.jodcast.net.
So you've been recently looking at the history of a certain Victorian astronomer.
Yes, this is Richard Anthony Proctor, who was an extraordinary Victorian figure, born in 1837, and I suppose was a kind of early form of Patrick Moore.
Really?
Insofar that he was a journalist, he was a man who was particularly concerned with passing astronomy on to a wider lay audience, and had a multiple body of books to his reputation, and was probably the first international astronomical lecturer, because he was highly provocative, and in that respect he was not really like Patrick. He made lots and lots of enemies in the Royal Astronomical Society. And in 1873, things got a little bit too warm, and he decided to embark on what was probably the first ever global lecture tour for astronomy, which of course included crossing the United States, Australasia, literally lecturing his way around the world to paid venues. And on one of his expeditions doing this, he actually met his second wife after he'd been widowed on the way back to England, a lady called Sally Duffield Proctor. And rather curiously enough, Sally Duffield Proctor actually outlived him by half a century. And you know, she ended up living in Altrincham.
Huh, so right nearby.
Very strange that you had this American lady. She came from Orange Lake County, Florida.
Yeah.
She was herself a very, very keen amateur astronomer, and very serious astronomer. And having lost her husband, met Proctor on the ship back to England. They married, and they actually lived very internationally. They sometimes lived in America, sometimes lived in Ireland. And, of course, when Proctor himself died suddenly in 1881... she came and settled in Altrincham.
What a remarkable bloke, even to start off with. I mean,
Well, she's an astonishing lady. And when you bear in mind, too, that, of course, Proctor had a daughter, and, of course, his daughter, Mary Proctor, by his first wife. Mm. And his second wife, Sally Duffield, was actually not much older than his daughter. And the two women actually became good friends, and they lived together part of the time until, in fact, Mrs. Proctor married a second time, and then they lived together.
Mm.
But then Mary Proctor actually died in 1957 at the age of 95, which was the year in which Jodrell Bank was founded, Sputnik went up, and The Sky at Night had its first broadcast. So this Victorian lady, born in 1862, actually could have watched The Sky at Night and could have seen Sputnik. Now, I think that is quite an extraordinary continuity.
There's a remarkable set of timelines, isn't there?
There is indeed. And when you have long-lived people, now, of course, Proctor himself died of fever, only sadly in his mid-50s, but his daughter was 95, and his wife was, I think, about 90 when she died.
These are remarkable lives. I mean, the lifetimes for the period, living out of the Victorian period.
Absolutely. Bearing in mind, too, of course, that his first wife, of course, died when she was in her 30s, I think. Second wife in her 80s. And in those days, you tended to either, I suppose, on the whole, go youngish, or in many cases, have a very, very long crack of the whip.
Mm.
And, of course, a lot of Victorian astronomers lived long lives. There's no doubt about that. I mean, people like Thomas William Webb, who was another great popularizer, was in his 80s. And, of course, in many ways, Proctor's great Irish rival, Sir Robert Stawell Ball, who was professor of astronomy at Trinity Dublin, and himself was a tremendous, exuberant character. I mean, he lived well into his 70s and was lecturing into his 70s as well, indeed, in 1913. And so, you know, you get a lot of these people who are very actively engaged for half a century or more.
Yes, yeah, certainly true, I think, with certainly people who are engaged in scientific work, who are, you know, head towards what we would call retirement age and just want to keep on going.
Just keep on going. And, of course, in those days, there was no such thing as retirement age.
No.
I mean, basically, you kept at it until you either dropped or you became so basically dysfunctional that they gave you a large pension and they put a deputy. But
yes,
they often let you keep the title,
mm-hmm,
even into extreme old age. But one thing, too, was very central with Victorian popular astronomy, and that's the growth of the mass media. And we think of, let's say this, doing a recording today, as modern mass media. The Victorians had their own exploding equivalent. It was the magazine trade, the railways, which of course got people and ideas distributed rapidly across the country, the electric telegraph, commercially produced photographs, and of course by the 1880s, photographs reproduced in books and magazines. And so literally you have an exploding media. And if you were a popular astronomy lecturer or a popular anything lecturer, whatever, and there was a big, big lecture industry in Victorian England, and everything from the life of Nelson to life on Mars and all sorts of stuff. And it was backed up by these often one-night stand lecturers.
Yes.
You know, Liverpool one night, Manchester the next night, Leeds the next, and often getting very handsome fees.
There was a huge appetite, though, from the Victorian public for anything scientific or anything that would increase people's, I guess what we'd call general knowledge. There was an amazing appetite. There were public lectures in the big universities.
Absolutely.
And they were packed all the time.
And you were getting this particularly going around people like Ball and Proctor, who were the two, like I said, the two great rivals until Proctor died very suddenly. Nothing unlikely to get, let's say, 3,000 packed into a lecture hall.
Oh, yeah. 3,000.
And, you know, you take on, let's say, a theatre, or let's say Manchester Town Hall,
yes,
or somewhere like that, and you could pack them in.
We can't imagine having a public lecture on physics or chemistry these days, you know, for 3,000 people.
Absolutely. you have on often what was seen to as very, very topical subjects, let's say around the time of the Mars opposition of 1877. Were there really living beings on Mars?
Yes.
Was it possible that these lines which people were thinking they could see on Mars were indicating that there was an intelligent civilization there? Speculating from that, was this a sort of super race, bringing the water from the poles to the arid deserts? And, of course, by the time that you get to H.G. Wells, would they invade?
Yes, of course.
And, you know, all of this is in the air, and this is 120, 30, 40 years ago.
Mars was a particular interest of Proctor, wasn't it?
But
Mars was a particular interest
of Proctor's. He determined the rotation rate in the early 1860s, and, of course, he does a number of key things which are very, very serious scientifically. I mean, one was the rotation rate of Mars. The other one, of course, too, was his major book on Saturn, which was established his reputation. He was a fine observer. He was Cambridge-educated, he was a professionally trained astronomer. And also, too, he'd worked for the great German astronomer Argelander, I think it was Bonn, and, of course, had plotted 324,179 of Argelander's stars. And, of course, this was a colossal geometrical exercise.
Yes.
And he was a geometer. Because, of course, in those days, if you read, it's especially astronomy at Cambridge or physics at Cambridge, it was not what you do today. It wouldn't be deep sky, anything like that. It would be celestial geometry. It would be the working out of all of the intricacies of Newton's Principia. And, of course, you would leave, if you had, as he did, a good degree, you would leave with a massive knowledge of mathematical geometry. And so hence, of course, when you're working from a German observatory, taking data from a German observatory, and you're putting it into a good form which is comprehensible in terms of tables, then you have it's a mathematician's job. But what he next does is interpret these star scatterings, because in many ways he was interested in cosmology, Proctor. And he started to find that when he examined his plotted positions for Argelander's third of a million stars, they didn't form a uniform or homogeneous spread. They tended to be in thick areas or places where there weren't very many. Now, of course, this was an idea later taken up by Jakob Kapteyn in the early part of the 20th century, the idea that in the universe, stars formed streams or bands. And, of course, Proctor is the first person to suggest this in the early 1860s.
He was also a theorist, too. He didn't just observe stars. He thought, why do they form these?
And, of course, one of the reasons I think why he did so much theoretical work is not actually holding an appointment and not being a university observatory director, as he would have loved to have been. What he does is rework other people's data. And he is very, very good at doing this. But also, too, what fascinates me with him, he was interested in the history of astronomy. And he tries to date the constellations. Now, in some essays he published in the 1870s, he was asking the question, where do the constellations come from? How old are they? And can we determine their dates? Now, of course, it was known at that time from the translation of Chaldean materials, which, of course, was just coming to be cracked, as you could understand some of the very ancient Middle Eastern languages by about 1870, that there were astronomical stories in these legends. Some of them may even have been Indian in their derivation.
And these are the constellations that we would recognise today?
Oh, yes, Cassiopeia, Perseus, Andromeda. In particular, that three. And he finds what he claims are cognates in Sanskrit stories for the Cassiopeia, Perseus, Cepheus, Andromeda.
The same characters.
Same characters, in slightly different names. And one suggestion was, if they were, let's say, North Indian, or what would be modern-day Pakistan in Northern India, then you go up into the Persian Gulf, you're into the Euphrates, Anya into the Babylonian world. Now, of course, this was an established trading route anyway, archaeologically. Why cannot ideas pass the same way?
Yes.
He wants to know when they were doing this. And he works particularly on the constellations that would have been visible at about 30 degrees north above the equator, which is basically the Mesopotamian desert, where the shepherds would have been. Now, what he says, you imagine you have these chaps sitting watching their sheep at night, and they're looking at the constellations, and they're making up stories and asterisms in the sky. Now, you have the one he particularly is interested in, Argo Navis.
Right.
Argo, the ship.
The ship, yes.
He says, look at the ship now, and it's diagonal to the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And for 30 degrees north, some of it would be below the horizon in brilliantly clear conditions, and others would be up in the wrong way. He said, if they were calling that a ship, they would have called it at a time when it seemed to just glide over the horizon,
right,
rising and setting and being fully upright. Therefore, how can we determine the age of the constellation? Try calculating from the precession of the equinoxes. When would that constellation have been upright, as seen from 30 degrees north? About 2170 BC.
Ah, that fits.
So, absolutely. So he's claiming that the constellations are about 4,000 years old, about 2,000 BC.
Because we like to think, well, we think, well, we are happy with the names of the constellations coming, you know, well, connected with Greek mythology, the various characters from the stories that we know from Greek mythology, but we're now talking about predating that by a substantial amount.
Probably could be. I mean, he mentions names from contemporary Sanskrit scholarship of where Cassiopeia seems to be corresponding to something called Cassiop, which, of course, has a parallel to it, and an Andromed. Now, of course, where the ultimate roots are, it's very, very hard to be sure. But, of course, what was happening in Proctor's time in the latter part of the 19th century, you were having massive amount of scholarship into the ancient Middle Eastern and Indian languages. People like Max Müller in Oxford, of course, he was bringing out a tremendous new understanding of ancient Indian culture and so on. And he's picking up astronomical stuff that's coming out of these traditions.
And we would call this an interdisciplinary
study. I suppose we would have done
study.
That, absolutely. And, of course, he didn't read these languages himself, but, of course, they were becoming available in good quality, either English or German translations, and, of course, he read German.
How did Proctor get in contact with or make the connection between what he was looking at and the constellations and his interest in dating these constellations with the stories coming from these guys who were studying
of course,
these languages?
What he claims, of course, is he mentions a number of Sanskrit scholars, a number of Germans particularly, of course, who were translating Sanskrit documents, and he cites a number of his key sources where he gets these from. He obviously is familiar with the modern stories or the Greek stories of them, and then suddenly realizes that they seem to have much earlier cognates. Now, this isn't for every constellation, but he mentions particularly the Cassiopeia story, the Cassiopeia Andromeda story, as having what seem to be parallels. Now, of course, whether that's the constellations that we speak of today, we don't know.
Right.
It's just the stories from India.
Yes.
But, of course, it does seem a related body of tales.
Yes.
And he thinks that these may have been perhaps brought up the Euphrates River, get into the Babylonian world, then enter Babylonian mythology, and of course we know the Babylonian mythology through Greek material taken on board from, well, a variety of people like Pythagoras and Thales and people like that, who then bring it into the Western tradition, and of course Ptolemy, who then puts together his 48 classic constellations from Babylonian sources.
Did any other contemporary of Proctor do similar sort of work, or people who followed Proctor? Did they?
Oh, quite a lot. It became quite an industry, actually. I mean, it's why the history of astronomy in some ways starts at this kind of period, and you start to get people seriously interested in ancient documents, ancient languages. You get the translation of the cuneiform texts from the Middle East. Egyptian material had been translated half a century before that. And, of course, work on Sanskrit. And Sanskrit was already a read language. It was never a lost language.
No, no.
But, of course, what starts to happen, it starts to enter much more clearly into Western awareness. And, of course, many of the Sanskrit stories then have these sort of lovely parallels.
What is the modern interpretation of Proctor's work now?
I think some of it would be considered, obviously, as limited by the sources available to him at the time. But his method of trying to actually date cultural events. And I think would be classed as still very, very interesting. There's no doubt about that. People like him are not being studied by modern historians.
For what reason?
I think so many modern historians of science, frankly, waste their time in what I call deconstructive criticism and basically nonsensical theoretical projects, and often ignore looking at real live working figures.
Such as Proctor?
As Proctor and many, many other people in the history of astronomy.
Hopefully things will change.
I hope so, because to me, the history of science, like science itself, is driven by data, is driven by information, is driven by theories which are based on facts. It's not based on pluck a theory from the air and see what we can apply it to, and how does it connect with some piece of French literary criticism or something like that, which sadly is all too common in the history of science.
Since science is data-driven and you know, of course, there's connections with theory, but you have to explain what you observe and what you see.
Absolutely.
I'm sure that's the way it will go.
The two will have to work very, very closely together.
Thank you very, very much indeed.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you. And a happy new year to everybody.